Blog Talk Radio.
Mode 1.
I want to rock with you.
You are now listening to Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
The following internet radio show is for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
There was a time when interracial dating was considered taboo. In today's society, not only is interracial dating and marriage accepted, but even same-sex dating and marriage is perceived as acceptable. What about multicultural dating? What about a Canadian man dating a woman whose citizenship is in Mexico or in the United Kingdom? What about a woman who resides in France, but she's dating a man whose citizenship is in South Africa or even the United States? Have you ever thought about dating a man or woman whose citizenship was in another country? Taking it a step further, have you actually done it? My guest tonight has lived in at least 6 different countries, and she has dated men from each and every one of those countries. She has written a book that encourages men and women to look beyond the boundaries of their neighborhood, cities, counties, states, and countries to explore the idea of global multicultural dating. Who is this woman who has written a book entitled The Globalization of Love and offers insightful wisdom about dating men and women from other countries and cultures? Her name is Miss Wendy Williams, and tonight Miss Williams will enlighten my listening audience with her stories of multicultural love as she takes time from Vienna in order to get up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Is this A. Alan Roger Curry of Mode 1 fame? Oh my God.
You're really good at this.
I gotta ask you though. Do you feel that black men have some type of unwritten obligation to date and marry someone in a race? You do.
I think they do. I think white people should date white people. I think black people should date black people.
Now, how did you come up with this idea to go to Italy with the women?
With the women, right. I just got so tired of hearing all my male friends talk about Brazil and how great Brazil is for them.
When I was growing up, I would go and hear about black women complaining about white women are stealing our men. Don't complain about your goods being stolen if you casually leave them on the front porch.
Have sex. Enjoy your life.
You know, men really want women to have standards. They really do. And I don't know how we got off of the mark there, but men do like classy women, and they want women to have standards.
I think you can be single and be very, very happy, and I think it's about taking the pressures off about being married.
I'm not saying that you should disrespect a woman. Never disrespect your woman, but the key is to not let her walk all over you.
Romantic love is very volatile. People don't realize it. And it is a drug. People don't realize it. Men and women do stupid things. Not all men, but sometimes you'll do something stupid.
I think it's a turn-on because just to see that person, just to enjoy themselves and just to watch them touching that person and making them feel good, I think that's kind of sexy, actually.
Yo, yo! Mode 1! This is Gerard McClendon from Chicago tonight and the McClendon Report. Right now you're listening to Upfront and Straightforward with my good friend, Alan Roger Curry. Mode 1, let the women know, fellas, what you're really thinking. Ha ha, Alan Roger Curry.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. You're on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and I'm your host, Alan Roger Curry. And you might be wondering, you might say, didn't he do an intro about an hour ago? For only the second time, actually, in the last 5 years, I'm interviewing two different guests tonight. And my guest is, for the second hour, I had another guest for the first hour. We had Lamar Hurd, who's a candidate to be the first black bachelor on ABC's reality TV show, The Bachelor. And now I am going to interview a woman who is the author of a book, The Globalization of Love. And it's a book about multicultural romance and marriage. She has lived in 6 different countries and worked internationally for 18 years. She is a native Canadian, but she's been married to an Austrian for 13 years. She lives in Vienna, Austria, which is where I'm going to be interviewing her from. And she's been in a number of media publications. She's had a number of interviews. So on behalf of the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and Upfront and Straightforward, I say, listeners, give it up for Miss Wendy Williams. Wendy, how are you this evening?
Very well, Alan. Thank you for the introduction. That's the first time I've been on the radio and had applause when my name is kind of fun.
Well, it's interesting that I said good evening because, as I just told us, you're in Vienna. It's early morning where you are, right?
It is. The daylight is just beginning. Yes, it's 5 o'clock in the morning.
Wow, that's interesting. This is like probably only the second or third time I've had like an international guest where there was a bunch of hours. And yeah, because actually where I am in the Chicago area, it's only about, I don't know, about 12 minutes after 10.
Okay.
Now,
you're not wearing your pajamas yet.
Ooh, say that again.
You're not wearing your pajamas yet. I'm in my pajamas over here.
You're in your pajamas. Ooh, see, Wendy, and I gave her a warning, so she knows. You say certain things like pajamas, and my little devil horns come out, and I tell you. But I'm gonna try to be PG-13 for my Disney. Listeners, remember today, if you're one of my longtime listeners, how I used to say I was always trying to appeal to my what I call my Disney Channel watching listeners. My Disney Channel watching listeners. Then Wendy,
Blog Talk Radio.
Can the people in the chat room hear me? Can the people in the chat room hear me? Let me know in the chat room if you can hear me. Now, Wendy, are you there?
I just redialed. I was kicked out of the line, and then I heard a commercial for helping me out of bankruptcy.
Oh. Lord have mercy. We ain't trying to help Wendy out of bankruptcy. Oh man, that's my last one. And listeners, yeah, I apologize, and if you listen to this as a, well, those who are gonna listen to it as an archive podcast, because as all my listeners know, once my show is completed, the live version, it automatically becomes a downloadable archive podcast, but I'm going to edit out this little technical difficulty glitch before it becomes, but yeah, that's what happens when you transition from one episode to another. Yeah, so, but now we're all good. I'm assuming, okay, yeah, my listeners in the chat room say they can hear me, so everything's good to go. My listeners can hear me live. My guests can hear me live. But before we got cut off, Miss Wendy, I was telling you, you mentioned me being in my pajamas, and I said that was bringing out the devilish side of me, because you know what's weird? I have to tell you this, and then we'll go on with the interview, but to give you a little backstory on me, I used to be this really kind of innocent, wholesome talk radio host. You know, I had a little provocative language here and there, but generally I would always joke with my listeners that I was always trying to appeal to my Disney Channel watching listenership. And then I got actually invited as a guest co-host on another woman's show. We used to have a show on Blog Talk Radio. Her name was Alexis. And she had a show that was very risque. And I became very X-rated on her show, and her listenership just shot up. She said she had so many women writing her letters, they were like, who is that nasty guy? So she said, Alan, you need to be more nasty on your show. I think your listenership. So sure enough, I just start being really, really nasty. Not all the time, not 100% of the time, but just here and there. Yeah, I tend to be. Matter of fact, I have another show called The Erotic Conversationalist, where I'm definitely very risque on there. But anyway, that's why you're going to hear me at times. You know, my risque side comes out because my female listeners, they just love it. But now, you grew up in Canada. What part of Canada did you grow up in?
In Northern Ontario.
Okay.
So far up in the north, where it snows a lot and it's really cold in the wintertime.
Oh, I hate cold weather. I used to live in Los Angeles for 6.5 years. I got spoiled. I came back to the Chicago area.
Yeah.
Man, I was like, man, this stuff is for the birds. All this high wind and below zero weather. Does it get below zero up there?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Very, very below.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now, what got you on this, wait a minute, somebody in my chat room said they know Vaughan. Are you familiar with Vaughan, Ontario?
No, I'm not familiar with Vaughan, Ontario. I'm from South Porcupine, Ontario.
South Porcupine?
Which is next. Yes, which I told you, I'm from a really small town in Northern Ontario. It's next to Timmins, and the listeners might know of Timmins, Ontario, because Shania Twain is from Timmins.
Oh, I used to have a crush on her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, she's worth having a crush on, isn't she? She's very beautiful.
Yeah.
And a very talented artist as well.
Yeah, she is. Okay, yeah, I had Black Man USA in the chat room. He brought up Vaughan, Ontario. So, Black Man USA, I don't know if you used to live there or you got friends there. So, when did you start developing this desire to see the world beyond Canada?
Oh, I've always had it. When I was 3 years old, I was given a book. It's called Around the World with Aunt and Bee. I don't know if anyone has heard this. And when I was 3 years old, it was a long time ago. So
it's called what?
And Aunt and Bee Around the World. World with, no, Around the World with Aunt and Bee. You know, the little six-legged insect, Aunt and Bee.
Oh, okay.
And a bumblebee.
I got you.
And they Aunt gives Bee a beautiful umbrella, and then Bee loses the umbrella, and they go around the world looking for this little tiny umbrella. And so they go around the continents and so on. And I think that probably started the whole thing. So I've always been very curious about what's around the next corner and the corner after that, and to see different countries and cultures and languages and all kinds of things. So And both of my grandparents were non-Canadian. So one set was from England, the other set was from Ukraine. So the stories that they would tell me, of course, were different than my experience growing up in Canada. And I think that piqued my interest as well.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first country? Okay, well, two questions. First, what was the first country you ever visited beyond Canada? And then what was the first country you ever lived in for a period of weeks, months, or years beyond Canada?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the first country, of course, beyond Canada was to go to the United States.
What did you like and dislike about the United States?
There seemed to be more people there. You know, that sounds kind of weird. It just seemed a little bit busier. There's more of a buzz going on. You know, Canada's a little bit sleepy by comparison. So I really like that. What I didn't like is there seems to be a lot of focus on food and like eating, you know, supersized meals and supersized Coca-Cola and fast food that you can pick up really quickly and consume really quickly. And I've never liked that, and I still don't like it.
Interesting. You mean like from like a healthy perspective, or you just don't like it?
Both actually. It doesn't seem healthy, but there was also something a little bit uncivilized about it. You know, not sort of sitting and enjoying a meal, but you know, going through the drive-through and just the huge volumes of food really bothered me. Why is everything so big? You know, sometimes we just want to have a snack, and a snack is not a meal; it's a snack. But a snack in America, from what my experience is actually the size of a meal. And then the size of the meal is just huge. And I remember being in Florida once with my husband, and this was just so funny. After two nights of dining out, we noticed that we would order, for example, a plate of pasta and not even eat half of it. And I, you know, really, I'm not exaggerating. So by the third night, we asked the waitress, or we told the waitress, we're just going to order one meal and share it. And of course, she thought we were being cheapos. You know, she was really upset about it because we said, no, really, we're just not that hungry. And then, you know, this mounting plate of pasta arrived, and two people, we eat sort of normal portions, and we're, you know, very satisfied, but we did not even finish the one plate of pasta. And so she was really surprised, but she thought we were being, you know, tight-fisted and didn't want to splurge at the restaurant. Do you know what I mean? So it was a little bit embarrassing and awkward. It happens that, too, with ice. You know, the Americans put so much ice in their soft drinks and in the iced tea, and I don't like the drinks to be so cold. And I'll say to the waitress, oh, you know, could you please not put so much ice in my drink? And one waitress said to me, oh, don't worry, honey, it's a bottomless cup. She thought I wanted less ice, so I would get more drink in the glass.
Wow. So, okay, let me do a quick recap. Wendy listeners thinks that size is overrated, that everything doesn't need to be so big. You know, that's the message she's getting across. She's like, man, don't worry about it. Size is not always cracked up to be. Everything
that's
doesn't
exactly
need to
what
be
I was trying to say.
Super size and all big and all that. It can be just a normal size. And yeah, and that she doesn't like really, really cold stuff. She likes stuff that's more like room temperature and warm and hot and yeah, that type of thing. Okay, so we got part of Wendy down already. okay, so United States. So now what was the first country you lived in extensively?
England.
England. Okay. I just went there for the first time about a year and a half ago.
Did you like it?
What's that?
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was fun. I actually went there. Now, first of all, I was talking about your MO. Do you know about my books, any of my books?
No, I don't. I'm sorry to say. No,
I'm insulted. My ego is hurt. But no, I didn't.
So I've been busy. I've been busy. That's why I haven't.
I know. You're a busy woman.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, listen, she's so busy, she goes like 48 hours without reading her emails. I can't even go that long. No, I have three paperbacks out. My most popular one is called Mode One, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking. Matter of fact, now I'm thinking about it. Before this interview ends, I'm going to have to get you to say, I always have my guests, and particularly my female guests, I always have them take the title of my book and stretch out the O's, and they say, Mode One. Matter of fact, let me hear you say that right now. Mode One.
Mode One.
No, you got to stretch out the O's.
That's stretched mode. Mode One. Mm-hmm.
No more. Mode One.
Mode One. So tell me what you liked about England.
Oh, well, see, you're messing up my chant, because, see, I usually play this chant.
Which is... Alan Roger Curry.
Your love front is straightforward.
Alan Roger Curry.
Mode One.
So I can already tell you. You got a defiant nature about you, you sassy woman, you. But no, my book, the gist of my book is I have, yeah, see, somebody in my chat room said, boo. Yeah, see, they booed you on that. That was one of the worst Mo ones ever. But I'm going to have you, I'm give you another opportunity before we end.
That's a distinction being the worst.
You said what?
That's a distinction being the worst. You know, that makes it memorable.
You
want to
be the worst Mode One woman on my show. The book talks about the four modes of behavior, at least as Alan Roger Curry sees it, that men exhibit towards men. I'll start with Mode Two. Mode Two would be your kind of prototypical Mr. Well-Mannered Gentleman guy, Mr. Nice Guy, and who approaches women and proceeds to engage them in a high degree of entertaining and flattering conversation. Mode three is a guy's two subcategories of mode three. One would be just a flat-out coward type of guy who would go to a party or a nightclub and just stand around looking at women, never approaching them. Or a man who approaches women and engages them in conversation that's very dishonest and disingenuous. He's basically full of shit. Mode four would be a guy that's a misogynist. He's very bitter towards women. And what was that sound?
Sound?
I touched
my microphone.
Oh, okay. Mode four, that's a guy who just has a profound degree of resentment and bitterness towards women. The type of guy who would say, man, I hate all women. They're all bitches. And then finally, Mode One, that's what I call the self-assured straight shooter. And he would approach women with a high degree of confidence. Within the first few minutes of the conversation, he would let the women know in an upfront, straightforward manner, which is what provoked the title of this show, what his romantic and or sexual desires, interests, and intentions are. And anyway... enough about the backstory of my book, but that book, it's one of the pleasant surprises of my book. It became very popular in a number of countries beyond the USA. I've done, like, for example, I do Skype consultations with guys in other countries, and I answer emails from guys from probably up to 20 to 25 different countries. And one of my strongest fan bases outside the United States is the United Kingdom. So I got invited to speak at this conference called the Direct Dating Summit in November of 2010, and that was my first time going to London. Now, I didn't like the way people drive over there. They can't drive. They drive on the wrong side of the street. I didn't like that. but other than that, other than their poor driving, you know, everybody was so friendly. You know, all the guys would say, top of the morning to your mate.
They're very jolly, aren't they? Mm-hmm.
And so I like that, and the women, you know, were cool, the ones I met anyway. And what was funny over there, the only funny thing, I kept saying the word duh a million times because every time I opened my mouth, I would say stuff like, hey, you know, I'm Alan from America. And they would look at me like, duh, like we don't know you're from America. we can hear the accent. And, you know, it's weird because growing up here, and I guess this applies to any country, when you hear yourself talk, nobody thinks they have an accent because you feel like you talk the way you talk. You feel like the way you talk is natural. And that was probably one of the first times in my life I've ever, it was, you know, I had a lot of people telling me, wow, you have an accent. And so that was kind of weird.
Yeah. But they're the default accent, right? That's where English started. You and I, we both have immigrant accents. We left the country.
Yeah.
We learned it in a country of immigrants. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
So you know, now it's funny. I'm talking about when I was over in London because you could say in my own way, that's one of the first times I started thinking about the globalization of dating and romance and my favorite word, of course, fucking. Because I met a lot of women that were really cool that I had chemistry with. And, you know, I was like, wow, I can see myself dating some women over here. You know, I thought about even the possibility of moving over there. Matter of fact, I have some friends who used to live in the United States that now live in London. But, yeah, it's like it's interesting that with the advent of the Internet particularly. Well, let me just ask you that. How do you think the advent of the Internet has contributed to the idea of global dating?
Oh, it's been huge, huge. It's so many different ways. I mean, the most obvious way is that it's enabled cheap and frequent communication. What we didn't have, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. So when you think 15 or 20 years ago, if you went to England or if you went somewhere and had a bit of a holiday romance, no matter how hot it was, once you get back to your country, it was difficult to stay connected. You know, we used to write letters and send them by snail mail. We used to talk on the telephone, you know, the big clunky thing that you held to your ear and it gets hot after 10 minutes. And also cost about, what, $2 or $3 a minute back then. And so I think Skype alone is probably responsible for a great share of international romances because it enables a couple to stay connected. You know, they can talk and interact, you know, several times a day very cheaply, and I think that's been huge. And, of course, Internet in general has been, and technology has been a great driver in the process of globalization and interconnectivity around the world at both the business level, which leads to the interaction of people at a more personal level. So that's a great question because it is definitely enabling us. And, of course, there people are meeting on the Internet as well. And that's something I didn't get into in my book. That's not what I researched. But, you know, people are meeting in chat rooms and where they come together based on a common interest and really feel the chemistry online and then end up meeting as well and falling in love. So it's enabling quite a bit of the globalization of love.
Now let me ask you. You said your first country you lived in extensively was England. Was that your first international dating experience?
No. When I was in Canada, I tended to gravitate towards, you know, foreign men or men with some kind of more exotic background.
And why do you think that was?
I don't know. I guess they had a mystique about that. There was something unknown, something mysterious, and I really liked that. As I said earlier, I always like, you know, sort of knowing what's around the corner on a global scale. And I guess I liked the idea that these men, they knew what was around, you know, some of the corners, and that was very attractive to me.
Okay. And, okay, after England, what was the second country you lived in extensively?
Slovak Republic.
Uh-huh. How was that experience?
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. It was still very much East Europe back then. And so it was fascinating to go from, you know, living in a capitalist consumer culture into a sort of post-communist non-consumer culture. That was fascinating. I was teaching English while I was there, so that was a lot of fun. And, yeah, it was a unique experience.
Okay. And then what came after that?
Then I did, in succession, Switzerland, Germany, Austria.
And how was Switzerland?
Good. I like skiing, so that was nice. And I love cheese and chocolate, so I felt right at home.
Now, what is it with women and chocolate?
It tastes good. I think it creates, what is it, oxytocin?
Really?
Is that it? You know, that feel-good chemical in the body? Mm-hmm.
Oh, I know. We've talked about oxytocin on a few episodes of my show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, okay. And then, now you said Germany. Now, see, I got a lot of friends who, you know, who did the armed services thing. They went over to Germany. And they love Germany. And I'm talking about brothers, too. Brothers said the German women, man, they treated them real well. So what's how was your experience in Germany?
Fantastic. I love Germany. Mm-hmm. Great. They have good cheese and good chocolate as well. They're just it's a nice country. It's nice to visit. It was nice to live there.
And then finally, Austria, and I'm assuming that's where you met your now husband, huh?
Mm-hmm. I met him while I was living in Germany.
Oh, you met him while you were in Germany?
And so, I just crossed one more border, and I've been here for a while now, for almost 15 years.
Now, that's where Arnold Schwarzenegger's from, right?
Yes, and my husband is from the same town as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Get it out of here.
Yeah, isn't that cool? But I should qualify that a little bit, because he doesn't really look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he doesn't really sound like, I mean, like he doesn't say, "I'll be back," or, you know. He just
that was pretty good there, Wendy. Okay. So what do you think made you become smitten with him? Like, is he somebody you could have become smitten with if he would have been Canadian too?
I think so, yes. Mm-hmm. He was, you know what I liked about him? And you'll appreciate this. He was very upfront and straightforward.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He was.
Oh, so that means you got to give me another, you got to do another mode one.
He was in mode one, and so it was a very nice experience. But he had to, and this is the thing with multicultural relationships or international relationships. You know, you have this chance meeting. You know, somebody from way, way over there meets somebody from way, way over here, and you have this short window of opportunity to make the connection. And then you know you're heading in different geographic directions. So, and at the time, I came to Austria for a New Year's party, and I met him that night. And the next day, I was going back to Germany, and he was staying in Austria. And so he knew, you know, he had to, I don't want to say take drastic measures, but he had to make his intentions clear from the very beginning, and that impressed me. You know, like as a Canadian coming from this North American culture where a lot of people have, you know, they have problems with the L word, for example. And he just came out and said, you know, I think I'm falling in love with you. And he said it in German, which sounds really cute. And so I thought, wow, that is so great that he just, you know, made his intentions very clear. And it was worth a follow-up visit. Do you know what I mean? It really intrigued me and made me want to get to know more.
Okay. How many languages do you speak?
Just two, just English and German. A little bit of French, but not so much.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, now what? First of all, when in your life did you find yourself saying, "I want to put a lot of my thoughts and insights and words of wisdom on paper"? So, in other words, when did you realize that you had the talent to be a writer?
Oh, I mean, I've always fancied myself as a future writer. I always knew that one day I would write a book. And particularly after I did, I wrote a PhD thesis, which is like writing a book, but just not as much fun because you have all this sort of academic framework that you have to work within. And it was actually in 2007 when I recognized, oh, I'm going to write a book about multicultural relationships. And the title came to me in a flash, The Globalization of Love. And it took a while to, I did dozens and dozens of interviews with multicultural couples from all over the world. So I was collecting all of these interviews knowing that one day I was going to write a book. But I was working a lot at the time and was just, too tired in the evening after working 12-hour days to write a book. And then shortly after my baby was born, I couldn't, you know, just go back to my consulting life and traveling around Europe. So I had to, find a new activity that I could do from home and I could do with flexible hours. And so that was the opportunity. I completed most of the research and had these mountains of interviews just ready to be turned into a book. So that's how it came about. So really from the day that I had the thought that I'm going to write the book, The Globalization of Love, to the day it was published was just over 4 years, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and The Globalization of Love. What was your main objective with this book? It's just enlightening men and women about how they can just, break down their traditional boundaries of dating within their own neighborhood, their own city, their own state, et cetera.
One of the goals was enlightenment, because I think that one of the most fundamental human needs is just the need to be understood. And my original goal with the book was just to put together a collection of anecdotes, cute and funny anecdotes of cultural faux pas and things that go wrong in multicultural relationships, and just to help people laugh about it and say, aha, we're not alone, kind of thing. And then while I was going through the interviews, I recognized that it was almost a responsibility to put together something that was more than just a collection of anecdotes. I mean, I do have, hundreds of anecdotes within the book, or dozens at least. And but I wanted it to be a little bit more information-based as well, so that it would be not only enlightening but also informative for the potential readers. So it was a combination of things. And I wanted to also shine a light on the fun side and the beautiful side of a multicultural relationship, because it is a very enriching way to go through life. It's more challenging, but it can also be much more rewarding and a more exciting way to go through life.
Okay, be a little bit more specific and elaborate. What makes a multicultural relationship more exciting and more challenging?
Okay. Well, if you think of what I call a monocultural relationship, where you have two people from the same country or same region, mm-hmm. and they have every relationship has issues, right? And I just put it under the category. I say every relationship has issues, sex, money, and laundry. Hmm? and maybe a few other things around that. But those are sort of the basic.
I've never heard that before. Now, I've heard two of those three, of course, sex and money, but sex, money, and laundry, okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, they're sort of mainstream issues in every relationship. You know, if you spend forever with somebody, it doesn't matter who that somebody is, there's going to be, you know, times in the relationship or issues in the relationship that are challenging. And what happens in a multicultural relationship is that these issues are simply multiplied because the basis for decision making is different. The basis, the cultural basis for what is considered normal, is simply different. And sometimes at the beginning, couples know that and they recognize that, but not always. So a lot of their discussions may be operating from, let's say, two different software systems. You know, where their expectations for what's going to happen, even starting on a first date and then through, you know, marriage and what happens in a marriage and the role of husband and wife and when children come along and dealing with family members and so on, their attitudes and their perspective on the natural, normal development of a relationship and married life is fundamentally different. And so that brings in kind of fun and interesting issues in addition to, you know, sex, money, and laundry.
Sex, money, and laundry. I'm going to have to borrow that.
Are you writing that down? I can hear you.
Well, of course, I would modify it because my listeners know I try never to say the word sex on my show. I really don't. I don't use words like having sex or making love. Those two phrases are just too conventional for me. I always have to say fuck.
Okay.
Matter of fact, okay. I've had at least three women who, two of the three were professional psychologists. They told me, said, Alan, you're the first radio interviewer ever to get me to say fucking.
You're naughty, aren't you? You're not you. And you bring out the naughty side in women, apparently.
Hmm? Oh, say that again.
Yes, Alan, you're being naughty. Now, back to the interview.
Yeah, well, that's my other signature phrase. Actually, the title of my third paperback is called Ooh, Say It Again, because I would always say it again, not only on radio, but even privately, I say that a lot of women. I say, ooh, say it again, whenever they say something like either kinky or flattering or out of character. But okay, the globalization. Now I'm looking. I haven't read the book, of course, but I'm looking at the table of contents. Now, one thing I would think would be inevitably come up with a lot of people is not only just the kind of general cultural differences, but you might have a lot of religious differences. Did you and your current husband, did you guys have any problems related to religion?
Well, we have different religions, but I wouldn't call it problems.
Okay.
And this is something that is there's a bit of a contradiction in multicultural relationships on the religious issue, because on the one hand, religion is the great divider within a multicultural relationship. It's one of the most difficult issues to overcome because religion is so deep within us. It's so internalized, and usually it starts when in childhood, that we are ingrained with a certain belief system, but that by the time we reach adulthood, we believe it is our own way of thinking. We don't even realize that this has been imposed on us by an institution and by our parents and by society. So we really hold on to our faith system very, very dearly. And when we meet a partner from a different belief system, then that's a real challenge to our most fundamental core value system. So in that sense, it can be very, very difficult. Now, on the other hand, and why I say this is so contradictory, is that typically if somebody is deeply religious and practicing their faith in a very regular way, then they tend not to get into a multicultural relationship or an interfaith relationship. Because if they're not flexible with their faith system and with their religion, then they're not going to accept a potential partner from outside of that network, so to speak. Do you get it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it is an interesting issue. But in the chapter on religion, what I describe is that couples find various ways to deal with the religion within their families, and it can be very nice for the children of interfaith parents, you know, to grow up experiencing dual religions, and they have a lot of fun with it, because then they get to celebrate throughout the year. You know, the house is always decorated for some kind of religious festivity that's going on, and they get a lot of presents, and there are a lot of big family dinners. So the kids really score. You know, they can have a great time with it.
Okay. Okay. Now, I see another section in your book called location, location, location. So for you to mention it three times, what's the issue with location, location, location?
Well, location is a really big issue in an international relationship, because where the couple lives can have such an impact on their own, you know, personal happiness and personal level of satisfaction in life. And what I mean by this is, if we just think about an international couple coming together and choosing, okay, are we going to live in my place or yours, kind of thing, my country or yours, and one of the first barriers is, okay, can we get the visas to live in each other's country? Do we speak the languages? Are we accepting of the dominant religions or dominant social practices within the society? Can we work in each other's countries? Can we make friends and sort of enjoy the same level of social life that we would have in our own country? And these are all issues that, of course, affect somebody's level of happiness. And if somebody's not happy in a relationship, then chances are the relationship is not going to be happy either. And so, just as an example, that sometimes there are certain professions or certain types of education that are not recognized in another country, or for some, you know, as you see this in the United States, where you have medical doctors from other countries driving taxi cabs because their medical license to practice is not recognized. And so there are things like this going on that may affect somebody's ability to, let's say, pursue the career that they've always wanted. If they don't speak the language fluently, and even if they speak the language well, it doesn't necessarily mean they can still work in that language. And so, for example, if somebody is a lawyer in one country and then moves to another to be with their multicultural beloved, they may not be able to, they won't have the law degree, won't be recognized in the country, so they may have to, you know, resit some exams, learn some, you know, new laws in order to be able to practice. They, even if they can achieve that, they may not have the language skills to be able to, you know, debate and negotiate in a second, in their non-native language, or be, you know, working on contracts and so on. So it really, I know a woman, she's from, I think it's Nigeria, and she's up in Denmark, and she's a hairdresser, and she's been working on black women's hair, and she's in a small town in Denmark, where, you know, there are maybe five black women in the entire town. So she said, you know, business is not booming, because she said, I don't know how to work on white women's hair. You know, she's offering to do, you know, those cornrows and so on, but it's, you know, since Bo Derek, that hasn't been that stylish lately. So it's things like that really impact the couple and the dynamic between them, and, you know, how they live their lives. And it may lead to a very different path than what was originally expected. A lot of multicultural spouses end up pursuing alternate careers because their original career path, it was simply interrupted by relocating to the new country.
Interesting. Now, I love chicken wings. All my listeners know I love chicken wings and peach schnapple. So I don't think I could ever live in a country that don't have good chicken wings and that doesn't have peach schnapple. But I noticed one of your chapters has to do with food. Now, what's the deal with food and multicultural relationships?
Well, that's it. You know, a lot of people, there are a lot of countries in the world that have sit down for this, Ellen, have never heard of peach schnapple.
So, what's this blasphemous? Are you kidding me? Those people need to be just arrested on the spot for not hearing
a cruel,
peach schnapple.
Cruel world, you know? And that's the thing, but that not everybody has an interest in peach schnapple. I mean, maybe once they knew about it, then they'd love it. But what is available in different countries, of course, is may not be to your liking, and just different attitudes toward food and what is good food. You know, like there's a whole continent that eats rice for breakfast every morning. How do you feel about that? Do you know what I mean? So when you sit down to a meal and think, okay, you know, what are we going to eat and when are we going to eat and how are we going to eat it? These are all very culturally based things that vary, greatly around the world. And I know in my own marriage, it's really funny. With my husband as an Austrian, you know, they're very proper about all of their meals, all three meals throughout the day. And so for breakfast, my husband will sit down and really have, you know, sort of a two or three course meal. You know, there'll be juice and coffee or tea, and he has a starter, he's a bit of fruit, and he has his muesli and maybe some toast and so on. And so it's quite an elaborate affair. And by contrast, as a Canadian, you know, I'm quite happy standing by the sink, you know, slurping my cereal with cold milk. And he finds my behavior barbaric. You know? So that's why the food chapter came about. There are just so many different ways of looking at food and how we consume it and how we should consume it and really the meaning of a proper meal.
Okay, now what's been the feedback so far on your book from, say, close friends, relatives, et cetera?
Well, the close friends and relatives, they're kind of obliged to love it, aren't they? So that's been really nice. They've really encouraged me. So that was really, really nice. And now, of course, the feedback is broadening a little bit. So now there are people out there who are not my friend and not related to me, and they still tell me that they like it. So that's been really wonderful to get the positive feedback, even from strangers.
Okay. Now, where can my listeners find out more about you and the book on the World Wide Web? Tell them where they can find you.
Yeah, the best place to go is globalizationoflove.com. And my blog is there, a little bit of information about me. You can buy the book. There's a link to Amazon on the website. And
now, Globo is your little nickname for global love?
Well, yes. GLOLO is the short form for the globalization of love. And it kind of became a bit of an adjective while I was writing the book. Because saying globalization of love and writing globalization of love takes a long time. So it was just shortened to GLOLO. And so then I started describing, you know, GLOLO couples and GLOLO children and GLOLO weddings. And then I even invented a drink, a cocktail. It's called the GLOLOtini.
The GLOLOtini. Is it good?
It is very good, yes.
Mm-hmm. Does it have any peach in it?
No, it has cranberry juice and champagne.
Cranberry juice and champagne. And
with a twist of lime.
Okay, I'm going to have to try this GLOLOtini. All right, now, you know, before I let you go, you got to give me one more mode one.
Well, with technology, it doesn't matter what I say, because I can say mode one, and then you can take that little synthesizer thing and stretch it out. You don't need me to say mode one or mode one. You just...
you're supposed to want to do that for me, Wendy. You're supposed to say, sure, Alan. Yes, I'll say mode one.
Okay, how long does it have to be?
No specific seconds, but more than just mode one.
Okay. Two, three. Mode one.
Mode one. Alan Roger Curry.
Mode one. Up front, straight forward.
Alan Roger Curry.
Now, see, was that hard, Wendy, huh? Was that hard?
It wasn't so bad. It wasn't so bad.
That was easier than me having you say the word fucking. But.
Is that your next project?
No, I've enjoyed conversing with you about multicultural relationships and the challenges and benefits of it. And I wish you nothing but continued success with your book. And I will be keeping track of you through your blogs. And, I plan on having Mode 1 just go majorly global. And technically it already is global. So who knows? I might find myself residing in another country in the near future.
Why don't you come over here? Why don't you come over to Austria? It's very nice.
Is there some honeys
over there? We could be neighbors.
Is there a lot of women over in Austria?
I don't know how many women. I guess, what is it, 50% of the population or 49% of the population is women. But, yeah, they're pretty. They're nice.
Do they give rhythm to the brothers?
I don't know.
See, that's important. You didn't think about that. I got to go somewhere where the women give rhythm to the brothers. Like for example, Germany. Now, I heard women give much rhythm to brothers in Germany.
Yeah, yeah. I see a lot of biracial relationships here. So, but what's neat in Austria, that a biracial relationship is really, you know, something unique. You know, you don't see it every day walking down the street. Still has it's a little bit special. You know, it has that flair kind of thing. So people sort of stop and look. Oh, wow, look at that.
Yeah, see, if I can find me a woman over there and, you know.
Yeah.
She
you like to ski?
And she likes chicken wings and pea schnapple. Hey, I'll be over in Vienna all day.
The chicken wings is going to be tough. It's going to be tough to find the chicken wings. I have to be honest with you.
You guys don't serve chicken wings in Austria?
They do have chicken wings, but I haven't found a really, really good place for chicken wings. They tend to be very greasy here, and I don't like the sauce that they use. So this can I do a calling to if there's anyone in Austria who's listening to this, if they know of a good place to have chicken wings, they should send me an email because I would love to go. And then if I find a good place for chicken wings, Alan, I'll invite you over for dinner. How about that?
Oh, you're so sweet. Yeah, okay. Okay, that's a deal. That's a deal. I'm gonna keep you up on that.
Okay.
All right, Miss In Your Pajamas. Hey, but no, it's been a pleasure, and again, continued success to you. And listeners, again, you can find her at theglobalizationoflove.com. And next week, I will be talking about polyamorous dating with George Pappas and Patty Summer. So until then, have a safe and enjoyable weekend.